vavatu, sahanao bhunaktu, sahavidyan karava vahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvisha vahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Narayanam namaskritya naram chaiva narottamam devim sarasvatim chaiva tato jayamudirayet. Welcome back. Excuse me. Om, there it is. The section called Shuka Anuprashna, which is a question-answer session, father and son. Unlike any that you've never had a question-answer session with your father quite like this, because they're discussing all profound Vedantic topics. In our last class, we saw the section where Shuka asked, what is the highest dharma? Now, remember from our prior class, dharma has many meanings. We have to choose the right meaning for the current context. And in the context that we're studying, dharma here means spiritual teaching, spiritual instruction. So the question then from Shuka to his father, Vyasa, is what is the highest spiritual instruction to which we saw this in the last class. Vyasa gives a surprising answer. He says, manasaha cha indriyanam cha, for the mind and intellect, aikagriyam, one-pointedness, eka agra, one point, aikagriyam, one-pointedness. One-pointedness of the mind and senses is paramam tapaha, is the highest tapas, and this is tadjayaha, that is better than sarva dharmebhyaha, all other dharmas, all other spiritual teaching. Saha dharmaha, that dharma, that spiritual teaching, paraha uchyate, that is the highest. Aikagriyam, one-pointedness. Now, that seems, on the surface, to be a rather surprising answer. Why would Vyasa say that one-pointedness is the highest teaching? There's so many other teachings. He could have said Mahavakya. That would kind of make more sense, wouldn't it? If you said the Mahavakya is the highest teaching, Tattvamasi. He didn't. He said Aikagriyam, one-pointedness is the highest teaching. Why? Well, what we're going to discuss today is that without aikagriyam, do you think you'll ever discover the true meaning of the Mahavakya? That's the point. So this aikagriyam is the key to the door. Without that key, you're stuck. Without the key, it's the key to unlock many of the highest Vedantic teachings. Why should aikagriyam, one-pointedness of mind, why should that be the key to unlocking these teachings? That's our subject matter. That's the next verse we'll see. Where Vyasa continues, he says, gochare bhyo nevrittani, gochare bhyo nevra yadasthasyanti veshmani, yadasthasyanti tada tvamatmanatmanam, tada tvamatmanat param drakshyasi chashvatam, param drakshyasi chashvatam. Yada, when nivrittani, when, and the topic is mind and senses. So yada, when the mind and senses nivrittani are withdrawn. when mind and senses are withdrawn from what? Gochare bhyaha, from whatever objects they tend to go to. So our sense organs tend to go out into the world. Our minds are full of all kinds of other mental objects, and our mind and senses are always engaged with perceptions of the world around us and with mental objects in our minds. This is gochara. Gochara is a delightful word in Sanskrit. Go means cow. Gochara, where the cows roam. Here, the cows are your mind and senses. So just as the cows roam in the fields, our mind and senses roam in the world. The world in which the world outside and the world inside, the world in which our senses and mind roam, is called gochara. Gocharebhyaha nivrittani yada. When the mind and senses are withdrawn from the outer world and inner world meaning mind, and stasyanti, they will be placed veshmani, in the veshman. That's a very interesting, wonderful choice of words. Veshman is a house, a dwelling. So when your mind and senses are withdrawn from their extrovertness and stasyanti, when they will be established veshmani inside. You know, there are so many times when the body is compared to a temple. You go inside a temple. Inside the temple on the altar is a form of Ishvara. In the same way, you go inside of this temple made of flesh and bone, and on the altar of the heart, so to speak, we find the God of the cosmos in the form of your true divine nature. That divinity is within, waiting to be discovered. And that waiting to be discovered is really the point of this verse. So, yada, when your mind and senses are withdrawn from their extrovert activities, when they are brought inside the temple, so to speak, interesting. Ishvara pervades the cosmos. But we don't recognize Ishvara's presence everywhere. On the other hand, when we enter a temple on the altar, we see Ishvara's presence, so we get it. The temple then is the nice. The temple is the locus for discovery. Ishvara is already everywhere. But you may not perceive Ishvara everywhere. You go into the temple and have a very clear, obvious perception of Ishvara on the altar. So the temple, mandir, is the locus for discovery of the all-pervasive Lord. In the same way, in this temple, going within, that is the locus of another kind of discovery, discovery of your true nature, Satchidananda, which is what's described in the second half. So yada, when you enter the temple of the body and mind, and when your mind and senses are made one-pointed and established within, tada, then tvam, you, is addressing Shuka, Vyasa addresses his son, tvam, you Shuka, drakshyasi, in the last line, you will see, you will discover param atmanam, the supreme self, shashvatam, eternal, unchanging, timeless. You will discover the param atmanam, the true self. How? Atmana. The same expression comes in Bhagavad Gita and many other scriptures. Atmana, by oneself, atmanam drakshyasi, you will discover yourself. By oneself, you will discover oneself. Or grammar allows us, if those of you who know grammar, this instrumental case can be ittam bhute tritiya. you will discover Atmana as oneself. Grammar allows that. Atmana, Atmanam Drakshasi, you will discover Param Atmanam, the Supreme Self, Atmana, by oneself or as oneself. Grammar allows for both interpretations. Meaning what? And this is the irony of all of Vedanta. The irony that's expressed by what we said before, Ishvara is already all this, but unrecognized, until we go inside the mandiram and make that discovery. In the same way, your true divine nature is an already existent fact, right? You already are that divinity. That's what the Mahavakya reveals, right? Tat Tvamasi, you already are that. I've pointed out before, very important, none of the Mahavakyas are in the future tense. No rishi ever said, you will become that. You will become Brahman. You will become full and complete. They've always said, you already are that, but that truth needs to be discovered. How will you make that discovery? Well, you won't make that discovery, pardon me for making a seasonal joke, you won't make that discovery at the mall. How's that? Nor will you make that discovery at work. Nor will you make that discovery in your kitchen or your living room while you're watching television. You get my point? So that discovery of that already existent divinity, that discovery is made how and when? First half, when your mind and senses is withdrawn from all their extrovert activities, when they're focused within, that's the aikagriyam that Vyasa talked about, then you have the opportunity to make that discovery. It's the key. That meditation is the key. That aikagram, one-pointedness of mind, is the key. Let's be very careful here not to make a common mistake. The common mistake, is, which many people believe, is that the meditative experience is the direct cause of enlightenment. Many people have made this mistake and continue to make this mistake. That is that meditation in and of itself is the cause for enlightenment. So here, aikagryam, one-pointedness of mind, it's samadhi. How many people have said and written, when you achieve samadhi, then you'll be enlightened? Say again? Look at this, and it's important to put this in proper context. A meditative experience is a transient experience like anything else. Transient experiences come and go, including Savikalpa Samadhi, including Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the highest Samadhi. Suppose you are a skillful meditator and you're able to put yourself into that condition that we call Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the highest form of Samadhi. You experience that Samadhi. It's a transient mental experience. And after a few moments, seconds, or minutes, probably not hours, after some time, that experience comes to an end. Well, after an experience is over, it's over. And I learned this the hard way, meditating long ago, and that is no matter what kind of meditative experience you enjoy, no matter how lofty it may be, when that meditative experience comes to an end, you find yourself sitting exactly where you were sitting before. And you find that the person who is sitting there is the same pardon my language, it's the same idiot who was sitting there before. And here's the point. If you sit down to meditate with your mind filled with ignorance, what are you meditating on? And you expect to emerge from that meditation enlightened? That doesn't make any sense at all. So that's why we're making a very important distinction here. This aikagriyam, one-pointedness of meditation, is the key to unlock the door. In this case, the door is the teachings of Vedanta. In other words, in order, as I suggested before, in order to understand the meaning and significance of the Mahavakya, in order for all these Vedantic teachings to click, as we say in American English, for that click, you may have all these teachings with you, but they won't click unless you are properly prepared, and this aikagriyam is that key to prepare you so that you can make this discovery. Here's the point. If you sit down to meditate with your mind filled with ignorance, you're likely to emerge from that meditation ignorant. But suppose you sit down to meditate with your mind filled with the teachings of Vedanta. And then you use the key. You have that state of aikagriyam, one-pointedness. That key unlocks the meaning of the teachings of Vedanta. And under those conditions, you can emerge from that meditation enlightened. But enlightened not because of the key, enlightened because of the Vedanta. Again, meditation being the key to unlock the teachings of Vedanta. It's Vedanta that creates that. The problem is ignorance. That which removes ignorance is not meditation. That which removes ignorance is knowledge. Knowledge born of the teachings of Vedanta. But to unlock those teachings of Vedanta, that aikagriyam, one-pointedness, is crucial. Okay, enough said. And with this verse, Vyasa concludes his answer to that question, what is the highest dharma? The highest dharma is meditation in general, aikagriyam, one-pointedness of mind and senses in particular. Why is it the highest dharma? It unlocks the teachings of Vedanta, allowing you to discover the true divinity that is who you are. All right. Having finished that, we have a series of three verses here at the end, which introduce a wonderful metaphor. A metaphor, it's a brand new topic, and it's a metaphor that describes the complexity of life. In our meditation session, I made reference to the fact that we get caught up in the rat race. So rat race is a modern term. I don't know if it may have come from psychology when psychologists were making rats run these mazes. But that's like 50 to 100 years ago, so that's a fairly modern idea. So instead of rat race, we're going to get a very traditional metaphor. The metaphor that describes the difficulty of worldly life, very often we use the metaphor of the ocean. Samsara, sagara, the ocean of worldly life. And it's quite an apt metaphor, because if you're out in the ocean without a boat being tossed around by the waves, it's pretty bad. And if you had a boat, or if you knew how to swim very well, it could be better. But anyway, it's a metaphor. But it's not the metaphor that Vyasa uses here. He uses a different metaphor. He uses a metaphor, one that actually occurs elsewhere. Metaphor of a nadi. Nadi means river. So instead of the ocean of samsara, we now have the river of samsara, which he's going to describe in vivid detail. It's really quite nice. I think you'll enjoy it. I like this. Let's begin. Sarvata srota sam ghoram, sarvata srota sam gho narim loka pravahinim, narim loka pravahinim, panchendriya grahavatim, panchendriya grahavatim, manasankalparodhasam, manasankalparodhasam. Start in the second line. This nadim, this river. What kind of river? Loka pravahinim. Pravahini is that which carries. That which carries along loka. All people, all of life, all of the worlds. The river of worldly life. The river of samsara. So imagine being caught up in the current of a rushing river. But rivers can be different. This is especially true in India. If you see in Rishikesh, if you see the Ganga in Rishikesh, say during winter or spring, it looks so placid, very nice. You could swim across, you could almost wade across in Rishikesh. It's not very deep. Very nice, pretty stream. But if you go to that same river, Ganga, in Rishikesh, in August, during the monsoon rains, it is a rushing torrent. And if you were foolish enough to wade out into that river, you would be swept off your feet by the powerful current. That's the river we're talking about. A river whose current is so powerful, it will sweep you along helplessly and continually. That's not a bad metaphor for life. We're being swept along day after day, swept along by all your jobs, all your responsibilities, all of these duties. They sweep us along helplessly. We are trapped in this current of daily life, and this river of samsara is in the first line ghoram. It's frightening. You see the Ganga in August. It's frightening. You don't want to go into that river. You will drown. So it is ghoram. It is frightening, and sarvata srotasam, and literally, flowing in every direction. If you can imagine the Ganga flowing and with its current flowing in one direction, that seems pretty frightening. But here he says, with the current flowing every direction simultaneously, it's hard to imagine being in a river where the current is flowing all directions. Maybe it's like being in a whirlpool. The current is flowing in all directions. What is worse than being swept along in a current of a roaring river? Only thing worse than that is being in that whirlpool. So stuck in that whirlpool, this represents the challenge of daily life. And it is so true, especially in our modern times and modern culture. Our lives are so busy and complex. And I think it's a fair statement to say that our lives are immensely more busy and more complicated than they were centuries ago. That's a fact. You know, centuries ago, I'm not romanticizing ancient life. I don't believe in that at all. Because some people say, oh, our modern life is so miserable, it's so stressful, it's so demanding. I wish I lived thousands of years ago. Well, if you lived in ancient times, almost all of us would be dead by now because life expectancy was in the 30s. So, and those 30 years would be 30 difficult years of trying to eke out an existence through subsistence farming. doesn't sound like fun at all. And if you get sick, you don't go to the doctor, you die. So please don't tell me that old modern life is so stressful. I wish I lived thousands of years. If you want to live back then, fine. I prefer. I absolutely prefer to live in modern times. But that being said, it's also true that our lives are in some ways more challenging, in the sense of filled with so many... Here we have to be careful. Do you think in ancient times you didn't have responsibilities and duties and work to do? Do you know, when your crop is ripe and ready to be harvested, it could rain any day and destroy your crop. Do you think you might feel a little stressed about that? Your livelihood depends on harvesting that crop. And the weather could change any day and destroy your crop and wipe you out and possibly lead you to starvation. Wouldn't that be a little stressful? And then you have to go out there and harvest that crop. Do you think it'll be a casual activity or a very driven and stressful activity? So let us not make the conclusion that everyone was so peaceful in ancient times. No, they had their own sources of stress. So yes, we have modern stress. There is ancient stress. Life means stress. But there is, I feel, a difference in modern life, and that is the complexity of life. We are overwhelmed by the complexity of life. We now use this term multitasking. So we're doing many things at the same time, most of the time, multitasking. And overload not only of activities, but of information. You know, you have your, this one, always you're connected to so many people and getting so much information from your phone, from the television, from internet. We live in a time of overload. And a kind of overload that really didn't exist. There was a simplicity. Again, I'm not romanticizing. Ancient life was still stressful and difficult, but it was more simple. Modern life is stressful and difficult, but includes all of this complexity. And the point here is that complexity immerses, that complexity robs our minds away. That complexity demands so much of our attention that our minds get caught up in all that complexity. And that's a nice metaphor for this river. You're caught in that whirlpool that represents how our minds are caught up in the complexity of daily life. And just as you can't get out of that whirlpool because of the strength of the current, in the same way, this complexity is everywhere we turn, so therefore our minds are continually challenged by this complexity of life. In the second line, he continues. He's having fun with this. So in this river of life, this whirlpool, this frightening current, panchendriya grahavatim. As if it's not bad enough, there are crocodiles in the river. It's already a dangerous whirlpool. Now he says, and there are also some crocodiles in that river. What are those crocodiles? Pancha indriyas, our five senses. Now, why would he compare five senses to crocodiles? Crocodile is one that's going to grab you and carry you away. So here, what happens is our five senses see something, and we are grabbed away by what we see. This one, you know what? When I do this, I'm talking about your telephone. It grabs away your attention. You've noticed that if you're with a friend and they get the phone call, and say, "Oh, give me just a moment," and they pick up the phone and they're gone. You've just lost your friend, whoever it is, because of the phone call. They get immediately absorbed in that. We're all subject to that, being dragged away, not by crocodiles, but by the various objects and distractions that we see in life around us. So, Panchendriya Grahavatim, the crocodiles are in the form of our five senses. These are the things that drag us away. And finally, Manaha Sankalpa Rodhasam. A river has two banks. Rodhasam. The two banks here are Manas, mind, and Sankalpa, thought. Which is simply to say that this river is a channel, and the channel is confined to our thoughts and mind. This river of life is not outside. This current, let's stay with whirlpool. This whirlpool, a river, is not outside, it's inside. The whirlpool is inside our minds, and the banks of that river, as it were, mind and thought. So this is a metaphor. Then he continues. Avyakta prabhavam shigram, avyakta prabhavam shigram, dustaramakritatmabihi, prataraswanadhim buddhya, kamagraha samakulam. Gets worse. Then it gets better. He gives his solution, how to get out. Start at the end. Kama graha samakulam. More crocodiles. Graha. Same word that was used in the prior verse. So graha, interesting. Literally, that which grasps, that which grabs you. That's the Sanskrit word for crocodile. So these graha, graha samakulam, this river is not just one or two, samakulam, it is filled, filled with crocodiles. But now these crocodiles are called kama, desire. Previously they were called panchendriya, five senses. Now he calls these crocodiles desire. Our desires that pull us in so many directions, our desires that grab hold of us. It's quite an apt metaphor. Desires that grab hold of us and pull us away. Sometimes strong enough to pull us off the path of Dharma. Not usually. But sometimes an unusually powerful kama, desire, just like a powerful crocodile, can be powerful enough to actually pull us off the path of Dharma, so therefore very dangerous. So this river, which is kama graha samakulan, filled with crocodiles, back up at the top, it is shigram. Two meanings. One here is literally short. It could mean that the river is flowing very, very quickly. It is shigra. It is very fast. Could also mean it is very short, referring to the metaphor of our life. If you're in that whirlpool, how long will you be in that whirlpool before you're sucked down? We talked about that extensively in our meditation session, the brevity of life. So this life is very short. The current is very rapid. It's only a matter of time before we are drawn down by that current. And this river of life is avyakta prabhavam. The prabhava, the source of this river, is avyakta, literally unmanifest, but not visible. So if you're standing in Rishikesh on the shore, you see this flooding river, you don't see the source of the river high up in the mountains in Gangotri. So this is all metaphor. So this river of life, it's not a physical river of water, it's another kind of flow, a flow that leads us from one life to the next, a flow that we've seen here many, many times. And I'll just remind you, that flow is avidya, kama, and karma. This is typical Vedanta, and very important Vedanta. So here, we are engaged in karma, actions. And for our actions, we get good and bad phalas, results. And we die before all those karmas are exhausted. And so therefore, for the sake of fructifying those unfructified karmas, we have to get born again, right? So when you're born again, are you born enlightened? Obviously not. You're born with ignorance of your true nature as being full and complete. Failing to recognize your innate fullness and completeness, that divinity, failing to recognize your innate divinity, we feel incomplete, insufficient, inadequate, and therefore we have kama, desire. And if we have desires, we don't just sit on our hands, as they say. If we are filled with desires, we get engaged in actions to fulfill our desires. And those desires yield more phalas, which fructify in the next birth. It even looks like a whirlpool. Look at that. Here is the whirlpool. How many times have we gone around that whirlpool, again and again and again? He says it is avyakta prabhavam. It's prabhava. Its origin is avyakta, unseeable. We can interpret that in several ways. One way is that whirlpool is a circle, cycle, and a cycle has no beginning or end, like a circle has no beginning or end. A line has a beginning and an end. A circle has no beginning and no end. So this is the eternal cycle of samsara. Therefore, its origin cannot be seen, cannot be discovered. It is beginningless. And this is one of the, if you really want to understand the doctrine of karma, you really must understand that you had no first birth. To have a first birth is illogical. You're born because of karma. So if you had a first birth, where did the karma come from? You get it? So according to the doctrine of karma, there's no possibility of a first birth, but rather what is traditionally taught is you have had an infinite number of prior lives. You've had an infinite number of loops around this cycle. That whirlpool has been going on for all time. In fact, not even for all time. Time comes and goes with each cycle of creation. There are periods when there's no time, during periods of pralaya, dissolution. Then time starts up again. So Your history spans not only this entire cycle of creation, but according to the doctrine of karma, your existence includes many cycles, prior cycles of creation, in fact, infinite prior cycles of creation. This is the prabhava, the origin of this whirlpool is timeless, the timeless whirlpool into which we've been found. And finally, he says, when I say finally, this is the end of the bad news. And the bad news here is dustaram. It is impossible to cross, to extract yourself from that whirlpool. Akrita atma bihi, akrita atma bihi. Here the word atma means mind. We have to give it the correct interpretation. Krita atma is one whose mind is prepared, krita. Akrita atma, one whose mind is unprepared. Akrita atma bihi, by those whose minds are unprepared, it dustaram, this it is absolutely impossible to extract yourself from this whirlpool of daily life. It gives some hope, doesn't it? Notice he said, it's impossible to get out. He didn't say it's impossible to get out full stop. He said it's impossible to extract yourself if you're not prepared. So I suppose if you were an extraordinarily good swimmer, maybe you could swim your way out of that terrible current. Here, there's a different way of getting out. Remember, it's not a physical river of water. We're talking about the current of our minds and thoughts, how to come out of that. He says, pratarasva nadim, he addresses his son, get pratarasva. You should get out, you should cross over, Nadim. You should extract yourself from this river, from this terrible current, this whirlpool. And how should you do that? Buddhya, with your buddhi. Now, I've translated it intellect here, but I think a better translation would be knowledge. Buddhi can mean knowledge. So through knowledge, you can extract yourself from this whirlpool. Now, he didn't say through effort. He didn't say through prayer, puja, rituals. Did he say? Did he say through, you do yogasanas? He didn't say. He didn't say through meditation you can extract yourself, although he talked about the key to unlock the door in a prior section. He said, buddhya, through the intellect, or better definition, through knowledge. Through knowledge, you can extract yourself from this whirlpool. Why? The answer's up on the board. How to get out of this whirlpool? Can you get rid of your desires? If I tell you, you suffer because of your desires. So stop desiring. Stop! I can utter those words, but it doesn't help, right? We don't choose our desires. Desires happen to us. Desires emerge in our minds and hearts, not of our choosing. So we have no control over our desires. How about karma? If you're full of desires, can you just decide, oh, I'm not going to satisfy all my desires. I'm just going to sit here and do nothing. Not happening. Not likely. So you have no control over desires. You have no control over acting on those desires. So then how can we get out of this whirlpool, this loop, endless loop? How to get out? He just said, buddhya, through knowledge. because knowledge destroys ignorance. That's how we get out. So knowledge destroys ignorance, meaning knowledge of your innate divine nature, knowledge of the fullness and completeness which you already are, that knowledge will prevent you from being from having compelling desires. I'm choosing my words very carefully right now. Compelling desires, those are the crocodiles, right? Those crocodiles that drag you along are the compelling desires. If you knew your innate fullness and completeness, you wouldn't have compelling desires. You'd have lots of likes, you'd have lots of preferences. You like certain things, you don't like certain things, but they're not compelling. They don't control you, and that's a problem. When desires control us, we're in trouble. So the compulsive nature of those desires is removed through this knowledge. And that's how we get out of this loop, out of this whirlpool. So buddhya, through knowledge which comes from the teachings of Vedanta, you can extract yourself from that whirlpool, leading to the final of the of these verses on this metaphor. Yam taranti krita prajna, yam taranti krita dhriti manto manishinaha, dhriti manto mani tam tirna sarvato mukto, tam tirna sarvato viputatmatma vichuchihi, viputatmatma vichuchihi. Krata prajnaha taranti yam. Taranti yam. They cross that river, yam nadim. They cross that terrible river. Cross means to extricate yourself from the whirlpool. So who is it that's able to get out of the whirlpool? Well, who is it that can get out of this loop are those who can remove that avidya. How do you remove the avidya? Through atmajnanam, knowledge of your true self. And just to take a moment to make that very concrete. We all know that we are conscious, sentient beings. No one needs to tell you that. You innately know that you are a sentient being. You are a conscious being. Problem is, you don't know the nature of that consciousness. You believe that your consciousness is affected by everything that happens in life. When things go bad, you think your consciousness is affected in a negative way. When things go well, you think that your consciousness is affected in a positive way. The fact of the matter is, your consciousness isn't affected at all. In fact, it's not even your consciousness. It is the consciousness, that one all-pervasive, unchanging consciousness. Now suppose, with the help of these teachings of Vedanta, you could discover that no matter what happens in life, the consciousness, which is your essential nature, remains unscathed. This is Vedanta. When you can discover that no matter what happens in life, that the consciousness which is your essential nature is untouched, unaffected, then what happens to the struggle and suffering of life? It is gone, removed in one fell swoop with this atmajnanam, with this knowledge of the nature of consciousness. You become enlightened and you become krita prajna, one who has gained knowledge is Krita Prajna, one who is enlightened. So, Krita Prajna, those who are enlightened, Taranti, they cross, they can extricate themselves from Yam, from this whirlpool. And who are those? Those are people who are Manishinaha, they're very wise because they've gained this. Manishina, wise, but not in the sense of panditya, scholarship. Scholarship won't, I don't need to tell you, scholarship doesn't make you wise. Scholarship makes you scholarly. I don't know what else to say. There's no wisdom in scholarship, nor is our goal scholarship. Our goal is this true wisdom. So manishinaha, those who have this true wisdom, knowledge of their true selves, those who are dhriti mantaha, could mean dedicated, could also mean those who are settled in themselves, those who know that they are unaffected by anything and everything that happens in life. Just an observation here. If you are trapped in the whirlpool, and then you happen to see somebody else who's also in a whirlpool, help me, you say. And then they say, I'll help you. So they swim over to you in the whirlpool. Now you're both in a whirlpool holding on to each other. Does that sound like a good solution to the problem? And isn't that how conventional life works? If you are yet to be enlightened and you're living amongst others who are not yet enlightened and you're helping each other, well, you're helping each other maybe manage going around and around in that whirlpool, but with the help of unenlightened friends and family, you will never extricate yourself from that whirlpool. But suppose there's somebody outside of the whirlpool who could, just to have fun with the metaphor, they throw you a rope. If somebody's in the whirlpool and they throw you a rope, that's not going to help much. But if somebody who is outside of the whirlpool, if they throw you a rope, that rope can lead you out of the whirlpool. We're talking about those who are enlightened, manishinaha. So those, their enlightenment not only frees them from suffering, but empowers them to help you so that they can throw you that rope. So, and what about those manishinaha, those enlightened ones? Tam tirnaha sarvataha sarvato muktaha. Tirnaha, tam. Having tirnaha, crossing tam, that river, that whirlpool, having extricated themselves from that river, they are sarvato muktaha. They are mukta, liberated. Now, we need to be very clear about what this liberation is. We call it moksha, freedom, and we need to say freedom from what? And let's be very clear about what it is. It's freedom from, the best answer, freedom from suffering is the best definition for moksha. Not freedom from rebirth. That's a secondary meaning. The primary meaning is freedom from suffering. Because here's the point. If moksha only means freedom from rebirth, when you get moksha, how does it help you now? If moksha is only freedom from rebirth, and you gain moksha, and you continue to suffer in this life like anything, what is that benefit? So, our definition of moksha is freedom from suffering. And then you might ask, how does this rebirth part come into the picture? Well, if you enjoy moksha, liberation in this life, if you get reborn, you'll be reborn ignorant. Which means you may enjoy moksha, freedom in this life, but then you get reborn and suffer some more. So in order to be free from future suffering, there is necessarily no rebirth. But notice that's a secondary meaning. The primary meaning is freedom from suffering. So when it says here, sarvato muktaha, free in all ways, it means free from suffering now, during this life, and then free from suffering later in the next life. Which means no next life. So we use the words jivan mukti and videha mukti. Many of you know these terms. Jivan mukti, to be enlightened now, to be free from suffering now. Videha mukti, videha without a body, jivan. While living, jivan mukti, videha without a body. After this life comes to an end, the body drops. There is no possibility of rebirth. We can establish that and take a half an hour. We're not going to do that. There's no rebirth, therefore there's no future suffering. Sarvato muktaha. Free now in this life and free from rebirth, therefore no suffering in the future. The person is viputa atma. And again here, Atma doesn't always mean Satchidananda, because viputa means free from sin. In order to become freed from sin, you have to have sin in the first place. So if Atma is viputa, freed from sin, it means that Atma originally had sin and then it got freed from sin. This is what the confusion that comes if you're not careful about the meaning of Atma. Again, Atma here doesn't mean Satchidananda. Atma means, in this case, jiva, sukshma sharira, the one that has karma. And viputa atma, the jiva who is freed from past karmas. That's what it means in this context. Viputa atma, you are freed from the effects of past karmas, so you cannot be reborn. Atma vit, a knower of atma, that's manishinaha, we saw in the first half. And finally, chuchihi, there's no word, look it up in a dictionary. I promise you, you won't find it. The word is shuchihi. Shuchi means pure, and it undergoes some spelling change due to grammatical rules. So the word is shuchi, pure. Again, pure means not any more affected by karma, which means after this life comes to an end, you will not be driven to attain another life in which you're born with ignorance and undergo suffering some more, stuck in that whirlpool. So this is the way out of the whirlpool then, is knowledge. The knowledge of your innate fullness and completeness, knowledge of the nature of your consciousness, being utterly unaffected by anything and everything. This is an amazing transformation of your worldview. Things that used to worry you before and threaten you before, those worries and threats just fall away. That's enlightenment. And with this, we come to the end of the metaphor and the end of the section. There's one more section of this Shuka Anuprashna, which is more metaphors. So we've got the metaphor of the river now, and we get a metaphor, two metaphors in the next section, a metaphor of a tree and a metaphor of a city. So we'll get those metaphors in the next class. A couple of quick announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, this is the holiday weekend, Thanksgiving weekend. So there'll be no teenagers class tomorrow morning, is canceled. And also no Vishnu Sahasranama class. Vasanti is back from India, but she's still jet lagging. So we'll give her some more time to recover. So there'll be no classes tomorrow, no teen class, no Sahasranama class. Library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.